In today's episode of Keep It Healthy podcast, we're thrilled to welcome Dr. Jane Van Dies, an esteemed gynecologist and assistant professor at the University of Rochester. Dr. Van Dies is a leader in digital health, co-founder of OB Best Practice and EQmetric, and a key advisor in the femtech space. With a rich background in OB hospitalis care and a strong advocate for gender equity in healthcare, she brings a wealth of experience and expertise to our discussion. As an active social media influencer, Dr. Van Dies embodies dedication to empowering women in healthcare.
Welcome to Keep IT Healthy podcast, the show hosted by people making things happen in technology, aiming to optimize healthcare delivery, health, well-being, and fitness. My name is Jan Kaminski, and I'm the co-founder of AppLover, a company dedicated to improving the quality of life with IT solutions and digital advisory. We started making this podcast to amplify great thinking to propel healthcare forward.
Tech companies are usually completely different from the world of standard medicine, in a sense. And I know that you probably work on particular problems with them and you advise them on particular problems. But not many of them actually is using advisors like you. And I was wondering, what are the threats and what are the risks that they're usually not considering before going on a market? Then and how the advisors, as you are, you know, helping them with that.
I feel like it really depends on whether or not they have a direct-to-consumer focus, or whether or not they are creating, for instance, a digital health platform where they want the simultaneous engagement of both practitioners, that is, you know, healthcare providers, as well as consumers/patients. So, for instance, a company like Flex that creates menstrual products, obviously they are DTC. And so they're using it an advisor more to make sure that they're using the right language, that, you know, they're anatomically and physiologically correct. For a long time, we would have conversations about where the menstrual disc, that was their first product, where it sits in the vagina. And how the anatomy of the female vagina is something that many women don't know about, in terms of what types of nerve endings are in the vagina. Are they sympathetic? Are they parasympathetic? Why is it that some women might have a pain with insertion and other women don't? What are the differences between where a tampon sits in the vagina versus where a menstrual cup or a menstrual disc sits in the vagina? So really working with them so that they can share accurate scientific medical information with their consumers, and at the same time, think about how their product is different from everything else that might be out on the market. Now, it was interesting because Flex, for instance, had acquired a previous menstrual disc company, but they rebranded it. And, you know, the rebranding has been fantastic, outstanding. Their online market, as well as their direct-to-consumer in Target and Walmart and CVS and Walgreens, is robust. And so they were able to both educate consumers on a device that already existed, but that wasn't widely in use, as well as create a lot of conversation about how we think about menstruation and are there better ways to menstruate. And obviously, I feel like in the last 10 years, we have seen the advent of a lot of better ways to manage menstruation, with period panties, with, you know, more discs and more cups. While they were one of the first thought leaders in this category, there have been a lot of followers because they've done such a great job at educating women and girls on the fact that there are products other than tampons and pads that women and girls can use, and that they actually might be happier with. So, you know, that's just one example. A different example would be, for instance, the advisory role that I had at Maven, which is a digital health platform. And obviously Maven 2 started out direct to consumer and got a foothold there, and then pivoted or added an employer benefit package or product. And so really thinking about what direct to consumers want and, you know, what employers want. And those can overlap, but they also can have different needs as well. So as an advisor, sort of helping them navigate both those lanes.
As you see that, and as you've seen that throughout the years, how has the digital health impacted the patient safety and care, especially in the obstetrics, based on your experience?
Well, I feel like obstetrics is a challenging space, in part because it necessarily is an amalgam of both in-person care as well as the potential for digital healthcare. There has been great research out of the University of Michigan showing that we actually have essential visits at certain points in time of the obstetric journey where women obviously need to be in person, whether it's because they need a lab draw, whether it's because they need an ultrasound, or the swab for GBS needs to be collected, et cetera. But then there are other points in the obstetric journey where they might be able to accomplish an in-person visit in a digital health platform. And to answer your question about safety, I think that, you know, one of the things that I see from women who are pregnant and even women who are seeking healthcare is that a lot of times the digital health platform can be an avenue to either allay their fears or to make sure that they are seen maybe in a more timely manner than they might otherwise have. Now, some women, when they are pregnant, have access to a clinic that is responsive. And if they call them, someone answers the phone, they get connected with a nurse who tells them, hey, either, you know, check out this over-the-counter remedy, or, oh my gosh, I think this is really serious. You need to go to labor and delivery or the emergency department. But not all women have access to someone who will pick up the phone and answer their question in a medically accurate way and give them the advice they need at that moment. And I really think that that's where some of the digital health platforms can be helpful and can be a patient safety net, because oftentimes it is easier on digital health platforms to talk to someone with who has medically accurate information more quickly. And while that person might not be their primary care provider for them in the pregnancy, they can answer questions in a medically accurate way and help them get the care they need. We see this especially in some of the mental health concerns that women in pregnancy have. A lot of times women will come into pregnancy with a history of anxiety, depression, or both. Maybe they're on a medication and they stop that medication because they're worried that it might harm the pregnancy. And the answer is these medications are safe in pregnancy. Having said that, they might find an exacerbation of either anxiety or depression, and they need to talk to, for instance, a counselor who understands how mental health diagnoses might change or might be exacerbated, for instance, during pregnancy or postpartum. And so having quick access potentially to a mental health provider when a woman is feeling either extreme moods or sleeplessness, severe anxiety, you know, if you are looking for a provider in person, as you know, that can sometimes take weeks, even months to get that appointment. And so the idea that they might be able to access a trained mental health provider even same day or next day can be a lifesaver for a lot of pregnant women.
I asked about safety because I know that in this particular field, that's so important. And from the digital product perspective, it's always being discussed. But you mentioned telemedicine and like telehealth in a sense. What, in your opinion, future developments do you foresee in this field, but especially in obstetrics and gynecology, because they also require some human life contact as well. And it's just cannot be missed in a sense.
Yeah, no, that's such a great question. So we've seen since the 1990s, a 2.1% rise per year in women presenting with hypertensive disorders complicating their pregnancies. In addition, we've seen a marked and frankly stark rise of diabetes in pregnancy, gestational diabetes. And so these are two conditions that can become life-threatening, either due to low blood sugar or elevated blood pressures. But they are also two conditions that are very amenable to a combination of in-person care combined with a digital or telemedicine type platform. So for instance, imagine that you see your OBGYN at 12 weeks gestation and you have a high blood pressure. Maybe it's not life-threateningly high, but it's higher than we would expect. Let's say it's, 139/92. And so you're sort of on the cusp of meeting a diagnosis for chronic hypertension. and your doctor wants to get more data. Is this an anomaly or is this a pattern and something that we need to address in order to, you know, potentially put you on an aspirin, which has been shown to help reduce incidence of preeclampsia in pregnancy, potentially need the need to put you on a medication, an antihypertensive. And so we give you a blood pressure cuff, show you how to use it, show you what parameters. And digital health has the ability to obviously connect your blood pressure cuff wirelessly to a Bluetooth device, and then to send that information to a digital health platform, such that, let's say you were at home and you had a headache, you weren't feeling right, you measured your blood pressure and it was 220 over 105, rather than having to call your provider, hope they answer the phone, that information could be delivered seamlessly, again, wirelessly, to your provider. It would create an alert. Someone would be monitoring, you know, all of these potential alerts that would come through, and then they would give you a call and say, hey, Mrs. Smith, we noticed you had a really high blood pressure there. We're worried about you. We'd like you to come into the hospital. We want to do further testing, make sure that you haven't developed preeclampsia, pregnancy, that sort of thing. And the same could be true of blood sugar. So your glucose monitor is attached to a wireless device that sends that data right to your provider. That person could be a nurse, and they could ask you, hey, what did you just eat? Did you have a piece of cake or did you have a cracker with hummus on it? Because, you know, if you had a cracker with hummus on it, this might be an indication that we need to increase your insulin, et cetera. And so these are ways that you can couple standard of care at home, delivering that data to a platform, and then having more immediate actions, actionable items on that information that was provided digitally, which can help to improve outcomes for that patient.
What other trends, other than telemedicine, telehealth, do you see in this particular field? What has, let's say, significantly changed in let's say 10 years from the tech perspective?
I do think the wearables, those kind of what I just described, I think, you know, wearables are able to get large data sets from patients and filter them in a way that allow those data sets to predict who might be at risk, versus if you're presenting to in-person care and you have the trend towards a hypertensive disorder or pregnancy, but for whatever reason, at that point in time, on that day, when you saw your provider, your blood pressure was normal, but for the most part, the data is trending abnormal. Without a wearable, you might not know that. You might not be able to predict that that person was heading towards danger. So I do think wearables, they provide obviously a lot of information about heart rate, blood pressure, sleep quality, glucose. Obviously, we have at BioRhythm the hope that we could have remote fetal monitoring so that you could monitor your baby's heart rate at home, versus having to come to a hospital and have that monitoring done. So there's a lot of ways in which wearables, I think, allow us to get more data, but also to get better quality data. So that's really one of the places that I see the most transformation over the last 10 years. Having said that, you know, I don't think we want to remove the human in-person element from healthcare. And so I always think it's important to caveat that digital health is best performed parallel to or in coordination with in-person care, and that human touch obviously is still necessary.
And you've also co-founded an organization that is focused on, say, achieving the gender and race equity in healthcare. And what are the key challenges that you think right now are not allowing the gender race equality?
I started that with Dr. Esther Chu back in 2017, and we had a lot of hope that if you measured the amount of inequity in healthcare, that you would then be able to pinpoint solutions to improve equity. The problem is that I actually don't think that the majority, now not everyone, but I don't think that the majority are necessarily interested in equity, which is to say power sharing. So when we looked at equity in healthcare, we were interested in not only closing pay gaps based on gender and race, but also the quality and the type of work that people from all walks of life experienced when they came to the hospital or came to the clinic to go to work. But what we found was is that even sometimes when those in the C-suite or leadership were presented with data that would improve their organization and make everyone feel that they could work to 100% of their ability and be acknowledged and rewarded either financially or with promotions or packages that would represent their talent, that actually wasn't always the case. And that, you know, when you wanted to share, ask people to share power, which let's face it, in healthcare resides still mostly with white males, that they weren't actually necessarily interested in power sharing. And so I feel, especially now in the last few months where we've seen such a backlash against DE&I initiatives, there is a sense, or I have a sense, that we still have so much work to do. And actually, last year, I dropped back from Equity Quotient. Esther has continued the company without me, in part because I wanted to focus more of my work on sustainability and addressing the climate crisis, but also because I did not see the type of progress that I felt was necessary to want to continue to invest both my time and my resources, you know, to addressing a problem that maybe the C-suite wasn't that interested to fix.
But was it because you saw it as a, like, the, let's say the system was sending the gear, in a sense it didn't go forward, or what was the main reason? Or you just didn't have time and you wanted to focus on, as you mentioned, a different topic?
Well, I feel like I've noticed both in corporate America, but in the public in general, that I felt that this backlash was coming about 2 years ago. And so whether it's a more rightward leaning in the political sphere and then the cultural sphere, I think that white backlash, white anger at the idea of racial equity is, it's such a strong force, and we cannot fool ourselves into thinking that, you know, even though the math makes sense of creating a company that values equity and values everyone's contributions equally, unfortunately, that isn't the society that we live in. And, you know, women and people of color are still struggling to be seen, to be heard, to be, you know, to have power shared equally. I saw on the Broadsheet, which is a newsletter that comes to my inbox every day, a Black female founder who created a fund, you know, a financial fund to address equity issues in the startup world, you know, she herself was receiving backlash for supporting or trying to help organizations that were founded by people of color, founded by women. I just think that the power structures that exist are not necessarily interested in sharing their power, even if it helps the bottom line, you know, for their company. And then concomitant to that, I also wanted to spend more time addressing the climate crisis. So it was twofold.
Obviously, it's not only about that, it's also about the inclusivity of the sector. And could you tell us more about the specific strategies or initiatives you have implemented or recommended to promote in this field?
Well, what we did at Equity Quotient, you know, we lived by the axiom, you can't manage what you don't measure. And so for a company to know exactly where it was missing the mark or where it was falling down or where or how women and minorities felt working in that company, that it was best to get anonymous aggregated data and then to present that data to the C-suite with a list of potential solutions that they could do to improve their culture and make their culture more equitable. Examples would include having data around the number of women, for instance, who were promoted to leadership positions and how long they were able to stay there, the number of women and people of color who felt like they contributed to the organization in often unpaid roles, the number of women and minorities who felt like the promotion schedule was fair, an analysis of pay rates for people, you know, and aggregate that data based on age, ethnic minority, identified, sex, etc. So we felt that if a C-suite had the ability to understand the raw data as to, you know, how people were advancing, being paid and promoted within an organization, and then how they felt. So there were subjective components to the data that we collected as well, and that we were able to aggregate that data. So it was de-identified. It wasn't, we were never talking about, you know, a single or even a couple individuals, but rather a group of individuals, but de-identified, that would give them a roadmap as to how to make their organization more equitable. And oftentimes we found that the C-suites were defensive, right? They imagined that their organization was more equitable than the data actually showed. And then when they saw some of the anecdotal information about how people felt or how they were treated at work, they were, I think sometimes they felt embarrassed, but they also wanted to kind of deny that that was happening under their roof. So it always presented a little bit of a reckoning in a way for the C-suite. But then the next question is, what are they going to do with that information? Because I think that it's one thing to know how inequitable your employees feel or are being treated. It's another thing to take substantial action towards remedying that. And again, that substantial action usually involved power sharing. And that's, I think, where a lot of organizations, you know, met their mark, because they knew that that would mean that, you know, people that maybe had gotten to places without the same degree of merit that they were holding women and minorities to might have to step down or might have to share power. And that became really, really challenging.
You wrote about gender bias and harassment in healthcare environments in general. And what was the impact you hoped to this research will achieve, and what motivated you to do this?
Yeah, well, I experienced harassment in healthcare and gender bias myself. So I wanted to make it better for the next generation. I think that every generation imagines that these problems will have been quote unquote fixed. And it's not until they finish their training, for instance, in our field, you know, they finish their medical school and their residency training, and they actually go out into the world, that they recognize that these types of changes are incremental. And unfortunately, that sometimes there is backsliding in terms of having equitable work environments. And so my hope was obviously to shine a light on the problem, to present data as opposed to just one person's stories. Having said that, stories are very powerful, but to also encourage every person in a workplace to be able to speak up for themselves. And, you know, what's been interesting, obviously, is that corporations know that they need to do work here, but what they oftentimes have done instead of doing the actual work is to, you know, for instance, require every employee to watch a video about sexual harassment, when data shows that these videos do not change the behavior of those who are harassing or who are more likely to harass fellow employees. But what you get are the inevitable checkboxes and, you know, compliance with standards or ideas that don't actually require that power is shared, but that they can then turn to their either shareholders or corporate board and say, hey, you know, we required everyone to watch this video, so I'm sure sexual harassment is solved at our organization now.
You write a lot in general, and you do a lot of research, but what piece of your research that you find particularly impactful or meaningful, and in what area?
Well, I would say kind of the area that I'm focusing on now, and maybe that's just because it's fresh in my brain, but I've been giving a lot of talks on the climate crisis and the intersection of women's and maternal health and, you know, fossil fuel related climate change, fossil fuel pollution. And I talk about fossil fuel pollution, not just as air pollution, but also the plastics and all of the chemicals that go into fossil fuel derived plastics and how they're having an impact on women's health and maternal health. And what I'm finding from audiences after I give give this talk is that they've never seen the data presented in that way, and that the data is actionable, that they want to make some changes, either in terms of the products that they are exposed to, in terms of the way that they're imagining these health concerns to, if, you know, if I'm speaking to physicians, how they're going to counsel their patients. And hopefully my biggest hope was that they would become activists like me and continue to speak out, because the fact is that, as the American Cancer Institute says, our babies are being born pre-polluted with fossil fuels. And we really can't help to hope to continue to have a healthy population unless we stop some of the practices that we're currently doing.
You even started the Options for a Sustainable Future, right? The organization. If you can tell us more about the organization, like what it's all about.
Yeah. Well, interestingly enough, a lot of people don't know this. I posted about this on Twitter last night, and I got a lot of people saying, really? And that is that healthcare contributes 10% of all greenhouse gases, or is responsible for 10% of all greenhouse gases in the United States. And we are an outlier there. Healthcare and other organizations in Western Europe, in Asia, do not contribute as much carbon emissions as healthcare in the US does. We manufacture more plastic solely for healthcare in the United States than the entire country of the UK does for all plastics manufacturing in their company, in their country, not just healthcare. So we have an over-reliance on single-use plastic in healthcare, and gynecology, when you compare it to other medical specialties, actually contributes an excessive amount of both emissions and single-use plastic compared to their other surgical specialties. So what we did at OBGYNs for Sustainable Future, which is me and Dr. Alexander Melnick, is we thought, how can we be part of the solution instead of being part of the problem? And so we're actually a subsidiary, or like we're an offshoot or of Healthcare Without Harm, which is a global international nonprofit whose job or whose role is to help make the public aware of the contributions that healthcare is making to the crisis, and then also look to how healthcare can be part of the solutions. Because when we are 10% of all greenhouse gases in the US and aviation is 2.5%, we have a lot of work that we can do. The problem is that I think the public imagines that healthcare is as a fundamental, and, you know, imagining that we are doing our best. And in fact, we are not doing our best. We have a long way to go. So a lot of our webinars and the education that we do is how to do better. So for instance, oftentimes gynecologists in the operating room can determine what supplies are purchased on their behalf to perform the surgeries that they do. And so they can take a voice, they can take a lead in asking for reusable devices that are not single-use plastic. So in my hospital, I've been speaking again and again and again, asking, can we go back to metal speculums, which have 1/5 of the carbon emissions as plastic speculums? Myself and another ER physician actually took a life cycle assessment class, boot camp, they called it, at Columbia University, where we learned how it is that you can conduct a life cycle assessment to determine, you know, how one thing in your healthcare setting, one product, might be contributing to carbon emissions, and then how to imagine a different product, you know, and how to reduce those emissions. So interestingly enough, we took apart a lighted plastic speculum, and inside it, we found two of those lithium disposable batteries. So a speculum might be used for 30 seconds, and then all that plastic and those two lithium batteries going into the landfill. And when I share that in my talks, the gynecologists in the room are shocked. They had no idea that this lithium was being used and that it's going in, that it's going into the landfill. And interesting, we went to one of the plastic speculum manufacturer's sites, and on the website, it's they purport that that their product uses less emissions. But what they don't calculate is that, yes, it costs, it takes more emissions to produce a stainless steel speculum than it does a single plastic speculum. But what they don't calculate is what it costs to dispose of that speculum. And let's be honest, sometimes those speculums are going into red bag waste, which is incinerated, which obviously uses heat, which off-gases harmful chemicals into the atmosphere. So there's a lot of ways in which we're not having an honest conversation about how the products that we're using in healthcare are actually harming our communities. So that's kind of our goal at OBGYNs for Sustainable Future, is to better understand how our practices might be harming our patients and the communities in which we're practicing, as well as what kinds of steps can we take to not be part of the problem.
Okay, that makes sense now. I mean, I see the connection, and I didn't know that, by the way.
I know it's I'll be honest with you, it's crazy, but most women also prefer a stainless steel speculum when they're having either a pap smear or an exam, especially if when I used to practice full scope and did clinic, you know, we would have a table and there would be a warmer, so the speculums were not only more comfortable, but they were warm. And I'll be honest, as a woman who's had these exams myself, highly preferable than the plastic.
By the way, is it this plastic used because of the cost mainly, or is it just easier to manage later?
No, actually, the cost for single use plastics is oftentimes higher. But if you think about it, what we're learning in the media and from great reporting, thank goodness for journalists that are doing this reporting, what we're learning is that, you know, fossil fuel manufacturers predicted everything that is happening in terms of the climate crisis and the fact that at a certain point, humans would recognize that they had to decarbonize if they wanted to have a livable planet. And so, you know, back in the 70s, they recognized that they would need to pivot to plastics in order to continue to sell oil. It's why, you know, in that movie, The Graduate, he says the future is plastics. They 100%, 10% of all global oil today is used in plastics manufacturing. And the greater the climate crisis has become, the more that oil companies are pivoting to plastic. So there's nothing quite like getting healthcare providers addicted to plastic by telling them that it has a better infection profile. It doesn't. By telling them that it costs less, it doesn't. But telling them that it's new or innovative, this type of thing. Yeah, sometimes the technologies in a energy sealing device that we use in laparoscopic surgery can be better, but at what cost, right? And I feel like in America, we are so susceptible both to marketing and PR, as well as to newer is better. And the fact of the matter is that newer isn't better. And in fact, some of these devices that we were using 20 years ago are superior in terms of not only providing great surgical patient care, but also in the harms that they don't cause the environment when we use reusable devices.
That makes sense. And I know you were a medical director of business development and operations at OB Hospitalis Group. And you referred that at the very beginning. But what is an OB Hospitalis, and how, in your opinion, has labor and delivery in the area of gynecology changed in the last 10 years as that you've seen the industry grow?
Yeah, it's so fascinating. So when I became an OB Hospitalist, there were very few. So I made that transition in 2013. And at the time, I took employment with a company called OB Hospitalis Group. And at that time, I want to say they had like around 40 contracts around the country where they would hire and then provide a hospital 24/7, 365 labor and delivery coverage. There's a variety of reasons that a hospital might choose to do this. Hopefully, the number one is safety. Studies have shown that when you have someone there on labor and delivery to manage obstetrical emergencies, which sometimes are not predictable, that could be a cord prolapse, an abruption, an eclamptic seizure, cardiac arrest, that having a physician able to manage these emergencies within, you know, minutes, as opposed to having to call an OBGYN provider, have them drive in to the hospital, you know, which could take up to 30 minutes or something like that. So having these providers increase the safety. But then also a lot of times what happens is that OB hospitalists receive sign out from private physicians. So let's say you have a group of seven OBGYNs and they all want to sleep in their bed that night. They can sign out their practice to the OB hospitalist, or they can hire an OB hospitalist that is a part of their group who provides that overnight coverage. That means that those physicians are able to work in clinic the next day, able to go to the operating room, and are not sleep deprived. So it can be a work-life balance and quality of life for OBGYNs in the community as well. And what we've seen take off is really a great expansion of the type of medicine that OB hospitalists perform. So for instance, I'm an editor at the Journal of OB Hospitalist Medicine. And so we are able as OB hospitalists to focus and sort of narrow our scope so that we are better at doing the things that we do. So we do a lot of emergency surgeries out of the emergency room. So ectopic pregnancy, missed AB, which is where a woman, you know, might have had a miscarriage, but she's continuing to bleed and it can be life-threatening, ovarian torsion, these types of things. In addition, obviously, to managing the labors of patients that are coming in. Unfortunately, sometimes patients come in labor at 20 weeks or 25 weeks or 38, and all of those management strategies are different. And so being on top of the latest evidence-based medicine inpatient obstetrical medicine can increase safety for patients as well. So there's lots of ways that this trend has increased. And I do think it's due to greater recognition of the importance of safety in the hospital, as well as improving the work-life balance for those practitioners who are what we call full scope, where they're doing clinic, labor and delivery in the operating room. In the same way that we saw that revolution happen in internal medicine, it's going on 40 years now. It used to be that your family doctor or your primary care provider, in addition to seeing you in the clinic, that person would admit you to the hospital. And if you needed to go to the ICU, they would have to follow you there. Obviously, that's not the standard of care anymore by any means. If you see a primary care physician in the community, they will turn your admission over to an inpatient hospitalist to manage your stay on a medical floor or manage your stay in the ICU. And in this way, absolutely have seen improvements in patient safety and quality outcomes and that sort of thing. So it's really a natural progression that we've seen this field of study, as it were, blossom and spread across the country. Now, the downside is that, as you probably know, there are lots of maternity units in the United States that are closing, oftentimes due to financial reasons. That is to say, maybe they're is an obstetrical provider in the community, and then that person retires, and there is no OBGYN that could be recruited to go to that community and fill that role. So I feel like while we're seeing increased safety in some geographies, we're also seeing decreased safety, decreased access in areas of the United States, especially where there just is no obstetrical provider anymore. So kind of both at the same time is kind of hard to watch all those closings.
I wanted to ask you, what advice would you give to young professionals, especially women aspiring to enter the field of obstetrics and gynecology?
I do work with a lot of residents, and currently at our residency, we have 100% women who are training to become obstetrician gynecologists. And my piece of advice to them is to protect their work-life balance. For me, that meant becoming an OB hospitalist. And for other women, it might look a little bit differently. But there are ways, obviously, in which corporate medicine will chew you up. And you've got to be able to set boundaries for yourself. That could be working part-time. It could be going to, you know, 0.8 or 0.6 or something like that. But my children are now, I have twins, they're 16. Their childhood is over. I was so excited that I became an OB hospitalist when they were 6 years old. And I'll be honest, a lot of the stay-at-home moms at their elementary school thought that I was a stay-at-home mom, because as an OB hospitalist, I was able to be a Girl Scout troop leader. I was able to volunteer in their classrooms because of my schedule. And being able to be really present in the lives of my children is priceless for me and hopefully for them. I don't know if they saw it that way, but that would be my advice to people entering the profession, is to think about what kind of work-life balance you want and to negotiate that future for yourself.
Thank you for that. And thank you for joining us today. And by the way, where can our audience find you? I know you're very active on Twitter.
Yeah, Twitter and LinkedIn are probably my two favorite places to post articles and have thought leadership and share the thoughts of others as well. So I'm at Twitter at Jane Van Dis, all one word, and then you can find me on LinkedIn as well.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much. And thanks for sharing your thoughts with us and all this.
Thank you for asking. Yeah, that was a great interview. Thank you so much.
Stay in touch with us. Subscribe to our podcast. Give us a like, comment, or share. If you want to reach out personally, you can find me on LinkedIn and Instagram.